Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond. Are you up for it?
Take my card and I stand in line. Make a buck, I work overtime. Work my back till it's racked with pain. Boss can't even remember my name. I show up late and I'm docked my pay. I feel just like another spoke in a great big wheel, like a tiny blade of grass in a great big field. To workers, I'm just another drone. To my bell, I'm just another phone. Just another statistic on a sheet. To teachers, I'm just another child. IRS, I'm another file. I'm just another consensus on the street. Gonna cruise out of this city. Gonna head down to the sea. Gonna shout out at the ocean, hey, it's me. And I feel like a number. I feel like a number. I feel like a stranger in this town. I feel like a number, but I'm not a number. Damn it, I'm a man.
This is Proposal for a Performance, a talk by Jeremiah Day, recorded in the studios of Radio Papesse at Villa Romana in Florence on July 15, 2015. The American artist Jeremiah Day works with performance and photography, crafting a highly personal and idiosyncratic form of realism. This monologue, a thought experiment in what would be involved in making a performance in a prison or a jail, sits ambiguously between being an artwork itself and a piece of critical reflection on art practice today.
Proposal for a performance in a prison. Johnny Cash performed in a prison. I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. But Cash had been in prison. He had been in that prison. And then later he performed in San Quentin. He hadn't been in San Quentin. But still, you could say that the people who saw him, that they were somehow, or were perhaps, closer to him, or he was closer to them than he was to the people who he performed in front of at Madison Square Garden, or in Paris, or on television. That was more, what, his community? It's a question of context. The question of context. It has a few parts. Part one, the moon. A quote from Hannah Arendt. Let us suppose, to take one among many possible examples, that the historian is confronted with excessive poverty in a society of great wealth, such as the poverty of the British working classes during the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. The natural human reaction to such conditions is one of anger and indignation, because these conditions are against the dignity of man. If I describe these conditions without permitting my indignation to interfere, I have lifted this particular phenomenon out of its context in human society and have thereby robbed it of its nature, deprived it of one of its important inherent qualities. For to arouse indignation is one of the qualities that excessive poverty, insofar as poverty occurs among human beings. This is a passage from a letter to a response to a critique of her book, Origins of Totalitarianism. There had been a critique that the book's tone or style was somehow sentimental. Other people praised this quality as passionate. But either way, Arendt felt like that there was a misunderstanding. Perhaps she had failed to make clear a methodological strategy she had been using. So she says she did not agree that the emotionally existing would overshadow the essential, because the emotionally existing would form an integral part of the essential. Quote, this has nothing to do with sentimentality or moralizing, although, of course, either can become a pitfall for the author. If I moralized or became sentimental, I simply did not do well what I was supposed to do, namely to describe the totalitarian phenomenon as occurring not on the moon, but in the midst of human society. To describe the concentration camps sine ira, without ire, is not to be objective, but to condone them, and such condoning cannot be changed by a condemnation which the author may feel duty-bound to add, but which remains unrelated to the description itself. So she says, to describe human phenomenon as if they occurred on the moon, out of context, is in fact a distortion. And one of the parts of that distortion is to describe things without judgment, when judging them is an essential aspect of their nature. And to take such an abstracted point of view on a subject, and then at the end add the judgment, which she says, at the end, like a condemnation added as a decorative element onto this other structure, that doesn't address it. That doesn't address this kind of distortion that can happen from decontextualization. That's the first part of context. The second part of context is thinking in a closed room, in a cell, a closet. For the Greeks, it was like a joke that Socrates had a wife. Philosophers shouldn't have wives. Philosophers shouldn't have families, because to philosophize requires a withdrawal. And this withdrawal then produces a kind of a thinking with depth. And this is a kind of intellectual activity, the ivory tower. But at the same time, while this adds a kind of depth, there's another kind of superficialization with this, which is that the thinking project has been produced out of context. Adding the aspect of context, putting it into the world, creates a kind of a methodological structure, because you are constantly having to reframe it in terms of the practice of making things public and not just taking the existing structures of public for granted. And this gets more important than when you start to think about your work, your art, getting your art out there. Johnny Cash performed in a prison. I was trying to make things that had to do with the public, with public life. And the assumption was that somehow you could find this public, or you could address them. That let's say we're going to take an art space that's not a commercial space, because a commercial space by definition is private. But we say we take a public one. Let's go further. Let's say one that is actually owned by the citizens of the city. The citizens legally own the art museum, the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam. And there's a history there. And the history of the Stedelijk Museum of Amsterdam is such that the people of Amsterdam, the art community there, doesn't feel like passive consumers. They feel like stakeholders. They feel as if they have a share there. So in this sense, perhaps this would be a place to address the public. That if one wanted to make art to try and deal with things that could be relevant to public life or civil society, maybe this is the right place. But somehow it's not. First of all, because the entire organization of the museum actually acts as if it's not connected to the public. Or rather, they think about the public realm in the way that is kind of dominant now in the Netherlands, or perhaps you could even say in Italy or in Europe in general, which is they think of it in terms of economic terms. They think about the museum in terms of tourism, in terms of ticket sales, or they think about it in terms of city branding. And then for the professionals who are involved with the museum, they think about it in terms of their own careers. They think about how it functions into their own position in the hierarchy of the international art world, and how the museum itself is ranked and understood within that hierarchy.
You're listening to Proposal for a Performance, a talk by Jeremiah Day.
And so in this way, in a moment of crisis, the Stedelijk Museum called a town hall meeting a few years ago. But revealingly, The town they referred to was not their neighborhood. It was not anyone who lived nearby the museum, or even the city of Amsterdam in general. The town they referred to was the members of the international art community who lived in Amsterdam. The point being that even when the museum itself approaches the public or approaches public questions, it doesn't do so from this kind of classical understanding of the public realm in general, like the neighborhood or the neighbors or the citizenry or civil society. And so even those people who go to the Stedelijk and think of themselves as stakeholders, actually, they don't necessarily think of themselves as related to the neighborhood either. It's possible that what they think of themselves as is stakeholders in a kind of social club, a kind of elevated, hierarchized place above society, a kind of aristocratic superiority of taste, perhaps. How is this possible? Recently, the online magazine, German Foreign Policy, made an interesting observation. They were discussing the way that the German government was dealing with Greece. And in one particular example, which is the claims of the descendants of the Jewish community of Thessaloniki. The Jewish community of Thessaloniki, at one point, until the Zionist movement in Palestine, at one point, Thessaloniki was the largest majority city, Jewish city in the world. And the entire Jewish community was destroyed by the Nazi occupation in the Holocaust. And the Jews were actually billed for their train tickets. And so the Jewish community in Thessaloniki is suing for reparations, and the German government is fighting this. But what's interesting is that at the exact same moment that they're fighting this, that they're trying not to pay the Jews in Thessaloniki, they're actually funding an art project that deals with the history of Jewish life in Thessaloniki. And in a section of a article titled Performance, German Foreign Policy magazine makes the following statement. The foreign ministry systematically pursues a, quote, culture of remembrance, unquote, based on aesthetical performance rather than material atonement. The foreign ministry systematically pursues a culture of remembrance based on aesthetic performance rather than material atonement. So you could generalize even further from this. Is it possible that the foreign ministry of Germany, or let's just say the tax money that goes to culture in the Netherlands or in Germany, is actually part of pursuing a specific kind of culture of aesthetical performance rather than material politics? Perhaps this is the sense that approaching the public realm through these white cube institutions, the feeling that this simply isn't working or doesn't work that I've had, perhaps this is part of it. Perhaps the cultural project of historical memory, while on the surface, seems as if it's an attempt to engage civil society to contribute with this classical language of de-barbarism, the de-barbarization of post-fascist Europe. But perhaps that's kind of a facade. And thinking about that is when I began to think about performing in a prison. It was the prison in Amsterdam. You see it as you go by on the subway, the towers. Supposedly it's kind of a nice prison. They have TVs. I proposed it to a curator. I had a project where I could make a work and we could pick which institution to approach. And I said, well, why don't we do something in a prison? And I think I didn't understand what I was saying at that point because she didn't understand. And so I let it sit. And then later on I thought about it, well, why would that be so crazy? I mean, is it so far-fetched? In fact, actually, I know someone who works in a jail, an old friend of mine who I grew up with, Paul Sullivan. He works in a jail, I think, someone told me, he works in a jail in Bourne near Cape Cod. So I could get in touch with him. I mean, it's been a long time, but I could get in touch with him and I could say, Paul, you know, I have this idea, you know, I'm an artist, I make this stuff, and I'd like to show my stuff in the jail there. Let's say he says yes. He could even say, hey, you know, that's fantastic. We have a great space. We have a stage. We have a lighting guy. We have a video documentation team. We have a budget. We always do performances in prison. Let's say it's really like that. Let's say it was easy. Then what? What would you do then? There's a tradition of theater in prison, but that, of course, is working with prisoners to perform themselves. Or even more importantly, it involves like a long-term engagement with the prison. I'm suggesting what I had in mind was just like hit it and quit it, pop in and pop out. Is that exploitation? Would you even really need to do it? Maybe it's just better as an idea. Maybe it's something you could just talk about or just talk around. You could just talk around a proposal for a performance in a prison. After all, this is art. It doesn't need to be true. You could just say you did it. You could lie. Why would you really need to do it? What would be achieved by really doing it as opposed to talking about doing it? And say you really do it. Are you doing it to make a point? Are you treating the people themselves, who are of course already kind of trapped, are you treating them like props? Are they like a theater set for me to make some argument about art and politics? Or say it's me trying to understand something, it's part of my own question, which it is. Say I go there and it's part of my own questioning. Am I treating them like research subjects?
This is Proposal for a Performance, a talk by Jeremiah Day, recorded in the studios of Radio Papesse at Villa Romana in Florence on July 15th, 2015.
In other words, to go and do that, is there a kind of a different obligation than to perform on the street for passerbys? I perform on the street sometimes, and I like it because the people who come, by staying, by lingering and checking it out, by being there, they become somehow different than audience. They become different than even witness. They actually physically make the frame around the performance. They call attention to themselves and they call attention to me, and then they somehow actually make space inviting passerbys to come, and the passerbys can come and see, and then of course get bored and leave or have somewhere else to go or think that it's that they're not interested or they don't like it. And this whole aspect of choice becomes an important dimension when you perform on the street. The choice of the audience. Because then the people who are there are really there. They're committed. What is the opposite of that is performing in a prison where people would have no choice. They would be told, Tuesday morning at 11, Jeremiah Day is going to come and do a performance. You have to be there. But there's this tradition, right? Like Johnny Cash. Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head that didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. I fumbled through my closet, through my clothes, and found my cleanest dirty shirt. I washed my face and combed my hair and stumbled down the stairs to meet the day. On a Sunday morning sidewalk, I'm wishing, Lord, I was stoned. 'Cause there's something in a Sunday makes a body feel alone. And there's nothing short of dying that's half as lonesome as the sound of the sleeping city sidewalk and Sunday morning coming down. Johnny Cash performing in a prison, having been a criminal, to the people who are convicted of something, even if they themselves are not criminals, telling these outsider stories. The outsider stories have a different meaning there. And the quality of watching photos of prison performances, the prisoners, even in this recent Metallica video that they made in San Quentin, the prisoners are like celebrating something somehow. And it's not just that it's a party or that they're getting to be on camera. It's a kind of an affirmation of their own, what's happening is an affirmation or a validation of their own marginality, because the musician's main content is about the marginality. Steve Earle, another country musician, he made a performance in a prison, and it was part of his parole. It was part of him, the terms from which he got out of prison. He'd been in prison for drug use. And he said that he wanted to thank the judge for saving his life, that he would have died from drugs if he hadn't gone to prison. And so he's on stage. He's quit drugs, so he's put on all this weight. He's kind of balding at this point, big sideburns, long hair, more on the sides than on top. But he's got this enthusiasm, this shared, intimate glee. I volunteered for the army on my birthday. The draft white trash first round here anyways. Did 2 tours of duty in Vietnam. When I came home, I had a brand new plan. I got the seeds from Colombia and Mexico. Plant them up a holler down in Copperhead Road. Now the DEA's got the choppers in the air, and I wake up screaming like I'm back over there. But you learn a thing or two from Charlie, don't you know? So you better not come down Copperhead Road. Copperhead Road. This song, Copperhead Road, about a Vietnam veteran who comes back to America and gets involved with the drug business, and then the police come to arrest him, and it suggests that he's going to fight them, that there's going to be violence with the police. You know, this is not Steve Earle's story. He didn't go to Vietnam, and he wasn't a drug dealer. But at the same time, his appropriation of the pronoun I, it doesn't feel false. There's a tradition of that, the tradition of the bard, that he speaks for others. And we imagine this character. We know it's not really him, that he's taking on a role. But at the same time, it's not total fantasy. For him to do this, the story has to have a kind of a, not even the story, the character, the tone has to have a kind of a plausibility to be effective. It has to be kind of non-fictional fantasy somehow. And so when Earle is performing these kinds of switches of persona in front of people who actually have experienced these things, it does validate them. But like I said, Steve Earle had been in prison. I've never been to prison. I don't know what those people are like. There's a video of the band Fugazi playing in jail in Washington, D.C. The guys in Fugazi, maybe they're closer to me than to Steve Earle, or closer than I am to Steve Earle. The guys in Fugazi's parents were professionals. They're white kids, punk rockers. And what's interesting about watching them perform in the prison in D.C. is the public in D.C. and Washington, D.C., besides being the nation's capital, is also mostly an African-American city. So the public is this African-American public, and there are these white kids coming in to play this kind of music that's not traditionally popular either. Johnny Cash sold millions and millions of records. For him to go into a prison is to offer something that people want in general. You know, it has mass appeal. Fugazi doesn't really have mass appeal. And in the video, they're playing one of the songs that they have that's actually about crime. Do you see something outside? It sounds like a gun. Stay away from that window, boy. It's not anyone that we know, only about ourselves and what we read in the papers. Don't you know ink washes out easier than blood? But we don't have to try it, and we don't have to buy it. Repeater. Repeater. 1, 2, 3, go. And so singing this song that's about hearing about crime to people who had been convicted of crimes, there's a disconnect. The public, these young black guys who are watching it, they're all black guys, I think. They watch it and they're kind of into it, but they also kind of think it's funny. And the band is kind of performing with their usual earnestness, but they're also kind of embarrassed. But what they do is they just go and they do what they normally do. They do their thing. They just do it in a different context. In my case, I have this fear that somehow so much of what I do has to do with describing, I don't know, difficult historical facts. You don't need to go to a prison and tell people that, you know, the world's unfair. It has to be more complicated than that. I think those people understand that the world's unfair. Maybe that's true all the time. Maybe you don't need to go and tell people that the world is unfair or, oh, by the way, things are really unjust. Oh, you know, the powerful, they control things, and the people who aren't so powerful have to suffer the consequences of their decisions. Maybe that's the same outside of a prison. On the train from Gatwick Airport to London Bridge once, I looked around and I thought to myself, all of these people are moving under extremely prescribed routes with video cameras surveying them. And they move from A to B to C because they have to. And there are rewards. If you do certain things better, you have certain conditions for sure. You might have more responsibility. You might have more benefits. You might even get time off. You might be able to have enough money to leave town for a while or go on a long holiday. You might be able to move around better in a car. But I thought, this place is like a giant minimum security prison. You have to ask, is this freedom? Outside's on the streets of the city. Is this freedom? I take my card and I stand in line. To make a buck, I work overtime. The boss can't even recall my name. I show up late and I'm docked. It never fails. I feel like a number. Feel like a number. I feel like a stranger. A stranger in this land. I feel like a number. But I'm not a number. I'm not a number. Damn it, I'm a man. Performance in a prison. Maybe you have to go all the way to a prison to begin to talk about freedom. To make a work for people who are not free. What's involved in constructing a work for people who are not free? Perhaps that's the beginning of trying to talk about freedom.
You've been hearing a talk by Jeremiah Day titled Proposal for a Performance, which was recorded in the studios of Radio Papessa at Villa Romana in Florence, Italy, on July 15, 2015. This recording is part of a series of public talks marking the conclusion of Day's Doctorate of the Arts project. A Kind of Imagination has nothing to do with fiction, Alan Capro and Anna Arendt, and a practice for a new publicness of art.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm, over and out.